Well, it's great to be here in Aspen. You know, living in Vermont, we actually came out here to warm up. It's been below zero now for about a week and a half. We still get out in it, but when the opportunity came to come to the tropics here in Aspen and basalt, we couldn't resist. So, you know, we're hoping to get a good tan and, you know, everything else one can do here. So 20 years ago, well, I guess about 22 at this point, my sister Amy came home and announced to my parents and me that she had a new project. It was going to be a radio show covering the election. I'm going to put this down so folks can... covering the election of 1996. This was the election of Bill Clinton, the re-election of Bill Clinton. I think this was Ross Perot was also in that, and Bob Dole. And it was going to be a daily radio show, the first independent, the only and first independent election show that there had been. And she told us that it was going to be called Democracy Now. So as her brother, I felt I really needed to give her sort of the unvarnished truth of what I thought. Democracy Now? That's what you're going to call a radio show? What kind of a name is that? Nobody's going to listen to that. And she said, well, what do you think it should be called? And I said, you know, you have to fly under the radar. You just kind of, you know, coffee with Amy. Morning Jane. But, you know, Democracy Now, that, you know, so anyway, as she has displayed over the years, she had no respect for authority, even within her own family, ignored my advice, and proceeded with this show that I privately muttered to my parents, said, well, it's a good thing it's an election show, so it'll be over in 8 months, because with a name like that, I don't think it's going to last. So 20 years later, here we are, and you know, part of what the die was cast for the kind of news coverage that so many of you know, really before 1996. It had been cast when Amy was at WBAI, the big independent, the Pacifica radio station of New York City, and she was the news director. And in 1991, she traveled to East Timor. And East Timor was a place that was completely, you know, underground. It was unknown to people. They didn't know what was going on, but Amy had heard what was going on, that there it was being occupied, but it had been occupied by Indonesia, and there was repression there on a scale perhaps unlike anywhere else in the world. Something like a third of the population had been killed. All of this behind an iron curtain. So Amy and her colleague Alan Nairn slipped in to East Timor and were there and witnessed and survived barely a massacre. And Alan had his skull fractured by Indonesian military. Amy may tell more of the story, but they escaped. And they came back and they shared with the world the story. It was broadcast on the major networks, CBS, NBC. And I think that's really where it began. You know, the idea that you go in, you know, why go to this place? And as Amy often talks about, it's about going to where the silence is. Going to the people who are not at the table, who are not in front of the cameras in the studios in New York or London, but bringing the microphones to them in the prisons, in the villages, in the streets. So this has come at a price, and I know this because whenever Amy gets arrested for doing her job, the phone call always comes to the family first. And so I've been up at 4 in the morning talking to Indonesian police who have arrested her when she tried to get back in. But there's a section in our book, there were so many of these, that we finally compiled them. And I had to keep asking Amy, were there others? And she kept forgetting because there were so many times. But we did chronicle them in what we have in here called an independent reporter's rap sheet. And as we write, as reporters, we shouldn't have to get a record for putting things on the record. But here's Amy's rap sheet for covering the news during the last 20 years. 1998, detained with Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland while covering nuns and priests from the pacifist Plowshares movement who threw blood on a B-1 bomber that had been used to bomb Iraq just 2 years earlier. 1999, detained and deported by Indonesia twice while trying to reach East Timor to cover UN independence referendum. 2003, arrested in front of the White House on International Women's Day with writers Maxine Hong Kingston, Alice Walker, Terry Tempest Williams, Honor Moore, and others while covering their protest against the impending Iraq war. 2008, arrested at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, while demanding that police release Democracy Now! Producers from custody. They had been filming anti-war protesters. 2009, detained by Canadian border guards while driving into Canada to speak about press freedom at the Vancouver Public Library and the University of Victoria. So, what is so threatening here is the idea of a reporter who is not beholden to the corporate interests who have for so long dominated what we come to know as news. That's what is under threat now in this age, as we have the media under attack in ways that it never has been before. But how is it that Democracy Now, prior to this, having this run of over 20 years and still going, it's really because the mainstream media created the hunger for independent voices that Democracy Now! Has filled. Now the media is fighting very hard to bring the truth, and journalists are doing this at personal risk, but so often, in the past, when we've had, for example, the Iraq War, where there was a study done during the Iraq War of all of the voices that were heard on PBS, ABC, NBC, CBS, to actually document how many people who appeared on the major networks were speaking out against war. Now, this is in the crucial run-up to the war. Out of 400 guests who appeared on all these shows, take a guess how many of those voices spoke out against the war. 400 guests. We have 2. Okay, you're a very pessimistic person. It's much more than that. Anybody else? 50? You're hopelessly optimistic. We have 8. Okay, this is another, very naive, pie in the sky. I did see this gentleman hold up at fingers. 3. Now there's a realist. 3 out of nearly 400 voices. I'm sorry, 2 was way off. It was 50% higher than you said. That's what the media has looked like. Where is the mainstream media when it counts? In those tough times, when being the lone voice to question, that's when we need independent voices the most. So, in any case, here we are 20 years out. We wrote this book, the subtitle of Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. And people are often, Well, it's easy to be discouraged, you know, especially in a shithole like this. But out there in the big world, we're seeing, as we travel across the country, resistance popping up everywhere. Just in Vermont, we saw at the beginning, a year ago this week, my wife, Sue Minter, was involved in helping organize the Women's March in our state. I'm sure you had one here. It was the largest protest ever in our state. Over 20,000 people. They had to shut down the interstate. Police had no ability to manage crowds of this size. That's just in one small little state. I'm sure you have similar stories here, and we know that in Washington it was enormous. And other acts of resistance that are popping up everywhere. That is the hope. And the place that you're going to learn about them is Democracy Now, where they're going from the suites into the streets to give you the real news, the news told by people who are ordinary heroes in their own community, who stand up, and these are the change makers and the news makers on Democracy Now. And they should be the voices that we are listening to and paying attention to, because that's where we're finding out where the hope is and where the future is. So for 20 years past, and I hope for 20 or more years going and beyond, Democracy Now! Has been the beating heart of this resistance, the network that lets you know that you are not alone and you are not crazy. So here is to my sister, Amy, who I think really is showed 20 years ago when she ignored my advice and continued to ignore advice from people that wasn't that didn't make any sense, to the woman who I think is the most tenacious, courageous, and the best journalist in America, my sister Amy.
Oh my God, you guys are so close. I'm going to move back a little.
Okay. Do you want this stool?
Start by singing. No, I'm kidding. Thank you, David. Thank you, Dennis. Oh boy, thank you, Katie and Kay, for being there all of these years. It's such a great honor to be here with all of you, coming from that shithole New York, where I was this morning doing the broadcast. What an enormous relief. And flying to Denver, staying there a couple more hours than I had planned, because, you know, the plane was in Aspen and just stayed here during the time that it was supposed to be picking us up in Denver. But I'm so glad to be here with you now. I mean, this last 24 hours has just been astounding, but every 24-hour news cycle now, it is very difficult to book a show because, you know, we have incredibly dedicated reporters, producers, videographers who work very hard on producing each show every day. And today was a special show. It was activists and actors, actresses who had been at the Golden Globes last Sunday as they launched the Time's Up campaign, Time's Up against sexual harassment, sexual assault, racial injustice, women leading this organizing around the country. And so we had on Shailene Woodley, who just was nominated for a Golden Globe, and she brought Kalina Lawrence, who is with the Suquamish tribe in Washington State, and women like Meryl Streep, bringing Ajem Poo, who is head of the Domestic Workers Alliance, deciding that their plus ones would be the women that are changing the world. And so we had some of those women on today. We had a whole group of women, including Tarana Burke, who dropped the ball in Times Square New Year's Eve. Now, the last thing way I would describe Tarana is to say she ever dropped the ball on anything, but she actually literally dropped that ball New Year's Eve. She's the woman who in 2006 started the Me Too campaign before hashtags and everything. Actresses picked that up and they credited her. But Tarana Burke is an African-American woman, a sexual assault survivor herself, who came to understand how so many girls and women were being held back by this experience in their lives. And so she started the Me Too campaign, that we have to be able to hear women describing their own experience. You know, movements take time. That was 2006. You never know when the magic moment will come. But when it does, and you're involved in social change, you will make history. You will determine the future. And that's what women all over this country are doing right now. It is astounding. And today, that was going to be our show for the hour, completely set. We usually don't set a show way in advance, just after the show the day before we start to work on it. But, you know, to get these women all over the country, Shailene was in France, and we've got a book studios in Seattle and Washington, Chicago and New York. And then President Trump, we hear, has talked about, well, much of the world as shitholes, right? He's talking about the continent of Africa. He's talking about Haiti. He's talking about El Salvador already this week. Salvadorans being told that they would have their TPS revoked. That's temporary protected status. So here were 250,000 Salvadorans who came to this country around 1991 for two reasons. There were two major earthquakes they were fleeing, and also the political repression. And this is so important to understand these countries from Haiti to El Salvador, and the connection of the United States to that repression. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times today where, when you go down many paragraphs, and that's where it's often more interesting to start, at the bottom of the article and then work your way up. They quote May Nye, a historian at Columbia University who has written extensively on Asian immigration to the United States, expressing dismay at Mr. Trump's remarks. She said, his vulgar racism is exceeded perhaps only by his ignorance. Countries like El Salvador and Haiti are in terrible condition in large part because of long histories of American support for right-wing dictatorships and crony capitalism. Why would anyone in Norway give up their social benefits, universal health care and a single-payer system, no college tuition and the like, to come to the U.S., which has none of it, she said. And then you have the Institute for Policy Studies putting out a statement today saying, in addition to ignoring the role the United States has played in making life worse in those countries, Trump's statement fails to recognize that if greatness is measured by how a nation treats its most vulnerable members, it's the U.S. that's a certified shithole. But the response of the world, and this is what is most encouraging. I mean, as David was describing, the day after the inauguration, you have the massive women's march. And I also want to acknowledge my sister-in-law, Sue Minter. Sue, stand up. Sue, David and Sue came from Vermont. Sue ran for governor of Vermont this past year, and it's people like Sue all over this country who are making an enormous difference in shifting the ground, what it means to represent people of every sector, of every social strata, across the political spectrum. That's what President Trump is managing to do right now, unite people across the political spectrum against him. I mean, the response around the world today, from the United Nations to Norway itself being revolted by President Trump saying, you know, we don't want these people from Haiti, as the New York Times said just weeks ago. He had already just said this, that all Haitians have AIDS. And why, if Nigerians come to this country, would they ever return to their huts? Which is why we came here, to go visit a hut. Would they ever return to their huts? I mean, there is no debate around the racism here. I'm not going to say he was universally condemned. Trump wasn't universally condemned. No, the former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard, David Duke, said in a tweet, he praised President Trump's disparaging remarks about immigrants, saying he spoke blunt, hard truths. And you think about what happened in Charlottesville, also being praised by the Klan as he protected the Klan. People who were self-described fascists, white supremacists, and Klansmen. Young people mainly, young white men, hundreds of them marching with their tiki torches across the University of Virginia, saying Jews will not replace us, chanting this. What was more terrifying than the old time seeing men in white sheets is that these men didn't feel they needed to cover their faces anymore. That's what the white sheets were about. They were afraid before of being identified, and now they weren't in this age of Trump. But the response has been enormous, and that's why it's so important that no one lose hope. The week after Charlottesville, the week after the killing of this beautiful young woman named Heather Heyer, who came out simply to say, no, that does not represent the best of us, and was killed when one of these white supremacists rammed his car into the protesters. The next week, when they said they were going to be protesting in Boston, by the end of that weekend, the group, if there was a dozen, that might be exaggerating, of white supremacists who went into a gazebo in the Boston Common for protection, because between 20 and 40,000 people turned out to oppose them. This is the hope. The women, the day after President Trump was inaugurated, all over this country. I mean, there was a lot made of President Trump saying his was bigger than Obama's, right? His inaugural crowd, right? On January 20th, right? You know, the pictures obviously told the story. I mean, he was maybe nearly right. You know, his crowd was 10% the size of President Obama's. His was 180,000. President Obama's was something like 1.8 million. But I have to say, 180,000 is a lot of people. And if Trump hadn't made a big deal of it, there would have been nothing else to say about it. So there was a lot made of the pictures comparing the two. But that was 9 years apart. Within 24 hours, three times the number of people who came out for Trump's inauguration. 500,000-700,000 women marched in Washington, D.C. to say, you're not going to roll back the progress that we've made. And it wasn't only Washington, it was Burlington, Vermont, it was Montpelier, Vermont, it was Salt Lake City, and it was Park City, Utah. I went to the Sundance Film Festival. We always cover the documentary track there, and we'll be going next week. I saw Kerry Washington there that year, last year. She was so exhilarated. The march in Washington was dwarfed by the march in Los Angeles that she'd addressed. She said, we're going to do it. And that was just days after President Trump was elected. Then you had the spontaneous uprising a few days later of people all over the country going to their airports because President Trump had announced his Muslim ban and went after any judge that dared to oppose him, called them so-called judges, right? And it wasn't only Trump. his attorney general, the man who represents the Justice Department, Jeff Sessions, in a conversation on a right-wing radio talk show, said after the second judge, this one in Hawaii, said no to the Muslim ban for a second time, he said, how is it that a man on an island in the Pacific can say no to the president of the United States? Jeff Sessions, you know, you should understand what the co-equal branches of government are all about as you represent the Justice Department. But the response of people going out to airports all over the country, President Trump's immediate response, I think this one was genuine. Who's paying them? Because that's the only way he could imagine people would go out and do something like this. This is what represents the best of America. And then you had, well, Democracy Now! Did a 5-hour broadcast on a freezing cold April 22nd, Earth Day. Remember when the March for Science happened in Washington? The most exhilarating part of that was all the young girls, the high school girls who were aspiring to be scientists. Thousands of people came out. It was one of the coldest days April 22nd, Washington, D.C. had ever seen. And they came out to march for science, for facts, to oppose a president who said that climate change is a Chinese hoax. And 7 days later, on April 29th, I think it was the second hottest Washington, D.C., April 29th, 7 days after the coldest, tens of thousands of people came out for the People's Climate March. And it just hasn't stopped. And so you have the Me Too campaign. Now, you might say, what difference does this make? You have 16 women who charge Donald Trump himself before he was president, who openly come out and say he sexually assaulted, harassed, or engaged in misconduct with them. And he not only is not arrested or investigated, but he becomes president of the United States. You could say, where is the progress? But I would say Me Too began then. And what happened to these women? Well, now they're coming together again. They haven't given up hope, and they are demanding a congressional investigation. They are demanding President Trump also be impeached, but they haven't stopped, and they've taken strength from all the women who've come out in Hollywood, all of the women who are domestic workers who are now speaking out, all of the women that they inspired, they are now taking strength from. And they're moving forward and saying, now we have to hold the man in charge accountable for his own actions. I mean, it has just been an astounding time. But I wanted to go back a year to what happened at Standing Rock in North Dakota, just for a few minutes, that brings together so much. It brings together Native American issues, the power of women. Today, talking to Kalina Lawrence, who was brought by Shailene Woodley, both of them went to Standing Rock, talking about you can't separate the abuse of women and the abuse of Native American women, no matter how bad it is for others. For Native American women, is so much worse, domestic violence. She said you can't separate the abuse of women from the abuse of Mother Earth. So I think that's a good place to turn to right now. Because what happened in the presidential election year was astounding when the people of Standing Rock, North Dakota made history. It was April 1st, 2016, when LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, the unofficial historian of the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota, decided to open her property along the Cannonball River to the resistance. The resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline, a nearly $4 billion project, Native Americans called it the Black Snake, that would snake its way from North Dakota to South Dakota through Iowa, Illinois, and hook up with a pipeline to the Gulf of Mexico. And the Native Americans were saying no. not near our property, not under the Missouri River, under the longest river in North America, that could contaminate the water supply for 17 million people downstream, native and non-native. No. But, you know, they weren't alone. The people of Bismarck, the capital of North Dakota, they had said no, and their views were respected. The people of Mandan, North Dakota, where the courthouse and the prison is that has housed so many hundreds of Native Americans for protesting, Mandan said no, and their views were respected. And so the Native Americans were just saying, treat us the way you treat any other North Dakotans. But they weren't so lucky. So they realized they had to organize. And so LaDonna Brave Bullallard opened her property, and she thought some people would come, and whoever would come, she would host them. But not only dozens, not only hundreds of people came, soon thousands of people were coming from around the world. And then other resistance camps were set up, like the Red Warrior Camp and others. And there were Native Americans from Latin America, the United States, First Nations from Canada. It was the largest unification of Native Americans that we have seen in this country in decades. And it's happening in this pivotal year, 2016, the presidential election year. The corporate media was hardly paying attention, hardly talking about the issue of climate change. And this is so important. You know, Democracy Now! Goes to every climate summit. We went to Copenhagen, we went to Cancun, we went to the People's Summit in Cochabamba, we went to Peru and Paris and Poland, we went to Doha and Durban. And you might say, why waste the fuel? We're the only daily global broadcast that is there every day of these summits. Why waste the fuel? What do they actually accomplish? Well, it's not so much for the gathering inside of the bureaucrats, of the scientists, of the government officials. It's for what happens outside these summits. Thousands of people come from around the world, the most hard-hit countries affected by climate change. I mean, we had a 15-year-old boy from the Maldives who looked into the camera and said, "You are drowning our country." You have the people of sub-Saharan Africa who say, you are cooking our continent. And they make their way. Some scientists from Britain will not take planes. They take trains wherever they go, the leading climate change scientists, because of climate change. And to hear these voices every day, sometimes they're getting arrested as they try to get into the conference, but then they come back the next day, and we're there every step of the way to be able to project the voices of people from the outside back to the United States, because the movements around climate change are so much more advanced in other countries than they are here. I wanted to stop for a minute, and if I can steal your book, and just read one of the voices, that was so powerful in Durban, South Africa. A young woman named Angela Potterai, who went to College of the Atlantic, a school I visited in Maine, she represented the youth. And what's so unusual is that, you know, they were always outside, but they were invited inside the climate summit in Durban, South Africa. It was at the very end of the conference, and they were invited to dress the world gathering. And Angela Potterai got up and she said, "I speak for more than half the world's population. We are the silent majority. You've given us a seat in this hall, but our interests are not on the table. What does it take to get a stake in this game? Lobbyists, corporate influence, money? You've been negotiating all of my life. You failed to meet pledges, you've missed targets, you've broken promises, but you've heard this all before. We're in Africa, home to communities on the front line of climate change. The International Energy Agency tells us we have 5 years until the window to avoid irreversible climate change closes. The science gives us tells us that we have 5 years maximum. You're saying, give us 10. The starkest betrayal of your generation's responsibility to ours is that you call this ambition. Where is the courage in these rooms? Now is not the time for incremental action. In the long run, these will be seen as the defining moments of an era in which narrow self-interest prevailed over science, reason, and common compassion. She said, there is real ambition in this room, but it's been dismissed as radical, deemed not politically possible. Stand with Africa. Long-term thinking is not radical. What's radical is to completely alter the planet's climate, to betray the future of my generation, and to condemn millions to death by climate change. What's radical is to write off the fact that change is within our reach. She said, this was 2011. 2011 was the year in which the silent majority found their voice, the year when the bottom shook the top. 2011 was the year when the radical became reality. She said, respect the integral values of humanity, respect the future of your descendants. And then she quoted Nelson Mandela, who said, it always seems impossible until it's done. And so she looked out on the world gathering and said, so distinguished delegates and governments around the world, governments of the developed world, deep cuts now, get it done. And she walked off the stage and did a mic check with all the other youth in the room, and they marched out of the room. And the head of the UN Climate Summit that year said, this really makes me wonder why we don't hear representatives of half the world's population at the beginning of the conference and not at the end. So she was hailed for what she said. And the next year we saw her outside the summit, and I said, Anjali, why don't you come in and describe what kind of progress has been made in this year? And she said, I can't. I've been banned from the UN Climate Summit this year. But their work continues. That has never stopped them. And I have to also point out, this is during the Obama years. And then we move into the Trump years. A lot of, sadly, the groundwork was laid during those years, whether we're talking about issues of climate or, for example, immigration. The horror we're seeing today. What President Trump said, just a culmination of the last year, of increasing the rate of arrests. We just reported yesterday on Ravi Ragbir, who is an immigrant rights activist well-known throughout New York, founder of the New Sanctuary Movement, organizing for so many people not to be arrested. And yesterday, he was arrested himself as hundreds protested, two city council members got arrested. And we'll see what happens in Ravi's case tomorrow. I look forward to going to Two Rivers Unitarian, the parsonage there, to meet with Sandra Lopez, to talk to her about why she's taken refuge. Just as when we were last in Denver last year, I got a chance to go to the Unitarian Church with Dennis Moynihan and interview Jeanette Vizgueta, who was there at the time. Jeanette was absolutely remarkable with her son, who is 10 years old, was at the time, as they were sleeping in the Unitarian Church there. And he put his arm around his mother. She couldn't go out. He said, she'll get arrested even if she takes the garbage out to help the people here at the church. Not that the church is a shithole or anything, but and she said she can't go outside. So he was going in a Cesar Chavez march with his six-year-old sister. And he put his arm around his mother and he said, we must be our mother's voice. I mean, the beauty, the heroism of whole communities right now who are under siege. We came back to New York, we played that interview the next day. Time magazine announced its, top 100 people in the world. Jeanette Vizgueta was among them. Now, she couldn't come to New York for the big gala, so they had a gala for her in the church. And, you know, the police or ICE couldn't come into the church to arrest her. Now, the police didn't actually want to come into the church to arrest her. The police chief told Jeanette Vizgueta he had her back. She was getting death threats. She said, you call me if there's any issue. So you're seeing these divisions right now between ICE and the police departments all over this country. Never assume a person's position based on the position, you know, they occupy. But even ICE it's too difficult, at least at this moment in time, to go into churches. So she had this party in the church, and the next day they arrested Arturo Hernandez, who we had met 2 years before, who had taken refuge in the church, who has a business, a tile business, with his brother-in-law, and was arrested, we think, in retaliation because they couldn't get Jeanette. He had come out of the church with a promise from the Obama administration that he would not be arrested, but this was a new time. And we see this all over. Right at the time Jeanette Vizguerra was in the Unitarian Church, Ingrid was down the road also taking refuge, an immigrant concerned about being deported. She came out when Jeanette did, and when Arturo was released, only because of people's activism this past year. And we just heard that yesterday her husband was arrested in a targeted arrest. This is very serious in this past week. Yesterday, Ravi, I can't tell you what a significant figure he is in New York, and the day before, the raids of 7-Elevens across the country. President Trump is laying out exactly what his plans are as he strips TPS from Salvadorans, from Haitians, from Sudanese immigrants. You know, this shithole comment comes out on the 8th anniversary. Today is the 8th anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti, where almost 300,000 people died. We have to be very clear why they were granted temporary protected status in the United States. And so it's so important to hear all these voices, but I'm going to go back to Standing Rock. Thousands gather through the election year. The corporate media is hardly covering this gathering. I mean, even the meteorologists, and I think that would be the most important place to start. I'm not talking Fox now. I'm talking MSNBC and CNN. While they have become oppositional, absolutely, when it comes to President Trump, and they will talk about climate change in their news reports. If he says that it's a Chinese hoax, they will ridicule that. But why people tune into TV all so really very often is to find out what the weather is, right? The weather report, tune into the meteorologist, the level of extreme weather we're experiencing in this country, whether it's the mudslides in Southern California that followed the forest fires there, I mean, the horrendous hurricanes in the Southeast, the polar vortex in New York and the Northeast. It's astounding. And how are people going to make connections between these seemingly completely different weather events, unless the meteorologists who are talking about them incessantly, as they actually should be, make the connection for us, right? Instead of just flashing those words severe weather and extreme weather across your TV screen, what about global warming? What about flashing climate change or climate disruption? That's what will allow people who are not stupid but to make those connections on a regular basis, because meteorologists are on television throughout the day and night. It's not just Fox that doesn't do that. It's almost religious when it comes to CNN and MSNBC. Their meteorologists will not talk about climate change and make that connection around these extreme weather events. But the Native Americans are. And they're not stopping. And they're saying they're dedicated to the sustainability of the planet, and they feel that it starts with them in Standing Rock in North Dakota. And even if they weren't getting the corporate media attention, you know, these networks that, when we cover war, are brought to you by the weapons manufacturers. You look at Pacifica Radio and affiliates and all the independent stations like KDNK, a very different situation. When we cover war, we're not brought to you by the weapons manufacturer. When we cover climate change, not brought to you by the oil, gas, and coal companies. When we cover healthcare, not brought to you by the insurance industry. When we cover economic inequality, not brought to you by the banks or the financial institutions, but brought to you by listeners, viewers, readers like you and not like you, who do have one thing in common, deeply committed to free speech and independent media. So we were covering Standing Rock from afar. But then on Labor Day weekend, you know, this is leading to the election in November. On Labor Day weekend, in the midst of the general election debates, and you know, not one of the moderators raised the issue of climate change in one of these general election debates. Not one. David and I just spoke at SUNY, at the University of State University of New York in Albany, with Bob Schieffer. And I was on a panel with Bob and said, you know, he was the anchor so long of Face the Nation and CBS Evening News. And I said, Bob, I mean, why is this? And he said, I think we made a mistake. And interestingly, David just shared that report from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You know, when it came to the Iraq War, only 3 of 400 voices in the 2 weeks around Colin Powell giving his push for war at the UN, February 5th, 2003, 6 weeks before the invasion of Iraq, there were only 3 of 400 voices that were against the war. When we raised this with Bob Schieffer, Bob said, I'm sorry, it's there, I have to take issue with you. And I said, why? Did I get it wrong? Is he going to say, I myself interviewed 10 people? And I was actually hoping that was the case. And I said, are the facts wrong on that? Are the numbers wrong? Did FAIR get it wrong? He said, no, of course not. So I said, so why do you have to take issue? He said, are you saying that if we're going to have Colin Powell on, we should have a peace activist on when we can have the Secretary of State? And you know, my answer to that was pretty simple. I think there's no one more than Colin Powell himself that wishes at this point that that had happened then. Because Colin Powell would later say the speech he gave that was the final nail in the coffin for so many. Because people trusted him. He dragged his feet on war when it came to the Bush administration, but finally gave this speech at the UN where he said the evidence was in. Saddam Hussein did have weapons of mass destruction. He says he was deceived, and it was a blot on his career that he ever gave that speech. If the press had been there and had challenged what he said at the time, that's our only hope. And so I said to Bob, you know, we don't have state media in the United States, but if we did, how would it be any different? Right? When you say, if I can have the Secretary of State on, why would I have a dissident voice on? That's precisely when you have the dissident voices. And certainly when a country is deciding whether to go to the war, it is the most important time because the lies take lives. So, back to Standing Rock. Labor Day weekend, Democracy Now! Heads to Standing Rock, to North Dakota. We've been covering it from afar, but we wanted to see what was happening on the ground. And I was there with my colleagues, Dennis Moynihan, Laura Gottesdiener, our producer, and John Hamilton, our videographer. And what we found there was just truly amazing. I mean, we fly in on a Friday, and the protests, I mean, you have Native women elders who are at the front of the protest in all of their traditional garb, and they will have a water ceremony and pick up glasses of water. And then they will walk forward, leading hundreds of people into the, I won't say the arms of, not arms that embrace, but arms that are weapons, of the local sheriff's department that is fully militarized facing off against them. I mean, this is rural back roads of North Dakota, and they are met by a fully militarized sheriff's department. They had tanks, MRAPs, automatic weapons, drones. You know the scene because you saw this in Ferguson. After Michael Brown was gunned down by a white police officer August 9, 2014, and the people rose up, the rage of this young African-American man lying next to his home, baking in the hot August sun hour after hour after hour after hour. The people rose up, and they were met by these fully militarized police departments from Ferguson and other suburbs of St. Louis. I mean, this is recycling in America today. You take the weapons from Iraq and Afghanistan, and you give them to the police departments of the United States. It is unacceptable, and there are some really powerful voices against this, like Norm Stamper, who's the former police chief of Seattle, Washington, who presided over the police riot in the Battle of Seattle back in 1999. This is the Clinton years when he was pushing the WTO, and thousands of people, farmers, high school kids, unionists, nurses, doctors, lawyers, artists, took to the streets and said no to the World Trade Organization. And they were met by a level of force from the Seattle Police Department, which was the largest export city in the United States. I mean, they ran out of tear gas so fast, Stamper had to go to other states to get more tear gas in. They arrested so many people. And what he said, he was ousted right afterwards. I mean, it was such a catastrophe for Seattle, what took place. And he should have been ousted. But we, Juan Gonzalez and I, recently had him in the studio. He said it was the worst mistake of his life. He said, what do you think happens with a police department when we are militarized? We look through the sights of our guns and our tear gas, you know, launchers, and we forget that who we're looking at are our kids, our librarians, our nurses, our doctors, and we just opened fire. And he is one of the great voices against the militarization of police departments in the United States. So this is what we saw in North Dakota. And the people would say to their local sheriffs, you know, we get that you're protecting the Dakota Access Pipeline, but what about us? Why aren't you also protecting us? And so this is how these confrontations would play out all over. And Saturday of Labor Day weekend, we were covering, there was going to be a horse ceremony, and Native Americans were coming from all over the world, and they would be welcomed into the camps with these formal ceremonies. And a group of Native Americans were going to the property where the Dakota Access Pipeline was about to be built, and they were planting their tribal flag. So we went to cover them. They didn't expect that the Dakota Access Pipeline was actually going to be excavating because it was a holiday weekend. So we come up on this property, and it's not where the Dakota Access Pipeline guards and the crews were working. They were working way down the road. And a judge was going to make a decision the next week about, well, whether this construction could go on with this mass resistance. And he had said to the Native Americans, okay, you claim this is your sacred burial ground. Prove it. Make a map. And so they said, okay, we'll make a map of the sacred burial grounds. And they did, and they gave it to the judge, and the judge gave it to Energy Transfer Partners, which owns the Dakota Access Pipeline, because judges give it to both sides. And on that Saturday, what the Native Americans believed was that they had taken their bulldozers and their equipment, and they leapfrogged from where they were way down the road to the site that they'd identified as their sacred burial ground to excavate it before the judge made his decision, so it would be a moot point. They would have changed the facts on the ground. And the people were furious. They were just going to plant their tribal flags. They did not expect the land to be being excavated that weekend, but that's what had happened. And so older women, little girls, they came up on the property. The bulldozers were operating at full tilt, and they stood in front of them. I can't express to you how dangerous this is. It made me think back to March 16, 2003, 3 days before the invasion of Iraq and another part of the Middle East and Gaza, to a young American woman named Rachel Corey, who was standing in front of a Palestinian pharmacist's home, a family she'd befriended with other activists from the International Solidarity Movement, because an Israeli military bulldozer made by Caterpillar in the United States was about to demolish his home. And they put on their bright orange construction vests, you know, fluorescent, and they stood in front of his home. And these bulldozers started digging up the land in front of the house, and Rachel was crushed to death. She came from Evergreen College in Olympia, Washington. That's how dangerous it is. And here were these women standing in front of these bulldozers as the land was being churned up. But this time they won. This time the bulldozers blinked, the drivers, and they moved back. One bulldozer, two, three, four, moving back as all of the people, and then more and more people from the resistance camps came running, and they were walking together, and the bulldozers were moving back. One, two, three, four, five, six of them moving back. And that's when the Dakota Access Pipeline guards unleashed dogs on the protesters. Dogs, attack dogs. They were biting them. Even the dogs, you could see, resist a little bit. But when the guards threw them into the crowd, they could only bite their way out. So the people were being maced, they were being bitten, they were bleeding, but ultimately they prevailed at a ridiculously high price. And finally, the guards with their dogs, the bulldozers, the tractors, all pulled back. We videoed all of this, and we posted it online that night. Within 24, 48 hours, there were 14 million views. So for any network corporate executive who would tell you, and they've often said this, and the reporters as well who I ask, and the anchors when I go on CNN and MSNBC, why aren't you covering climate change? They say, because people's eyes glaze over. This is the answer to that. 14 million views, any corporate network executive would drool at those numbers. People do care if they can see the facts on the ground. So we had to fly back to New York. We continued our coverage from New York that week. The judge was going to rule on Friday. On Thursday, the North Dakota governor, Dalrymple, at the time, called out the National Guard. It did not look good for the tribe on Friday. Oh, and they also quietly said on Thursday, well, they issued an arrest warrant for me. I didn't know that at the time. So we did our show on Friday, and Nermeen Sheikh, co-host on Democracy Now!, and I headed to Canada. We weren't fleeing. We were invited by the Toronto International Film Festival to speak after a film that had come out called, well, it's about I.F. Stone. And, you know, I.F. Stone, the great muckraking journalist who told young journalists, if you can remember two words, remember governments lie. And if you can remember three, remember all governments lie. So then they were looking at journalistic organizations that follow in the muckraker I.F. Stone's footsteps, and they looked at Democracy Now! So we came to speak after the film, and I wasn't going to go, but then I thought, you know, we just witnessed this in North Dakota. And people in Canada care about First Nations. They need to hear what's happening just over the border. So we went and we spoke on Friday night, and Saturday we were invited to the University of Toronto, and there were hundreds of people there, and we were each giving a talk, and I spoke. And in the middle of my talk, you know, I always have my phone with me, and I get this text, and it says, you're under arrest. So, but I was like in the middle of my talk, and I thought, wait, did someone just send, like, is this a joke from the audience? And so I was trying to talk and focus on what I was saying and figure out, what is this, like some kind of spam thing? It says there's an arrest warrant for you. And so I don't want to say anything if this is true, because, I mean, you know, if there's an arrest warrant for you, you're not going to be automatically picked up. You have to have some kind of interaction with police, FBI, or border guards. And I'm in Canada, I have to go back over the border. So I knew, I cannot tell people what I have just seen, and I did see it was a North Dakota number, so this did not look good. So I just looked up and I said, could someone call me a cab? And I went back, I went to the airport, and I thought, if I can get over the border before the arrest warrant goes into the system, if in fact this is true. And I did, and I came back to New York. But, you know, I didn't take this arrest warrant personally. I really thought it was a warning to all journalists, do not come to North Dakota, which is exactly why we had to go back. And particularly, I felt it was important for young journalists. If you want to go and cover something like this, it was historic. You're not going to be able to go if you think you're going to end up in jail. You don't have the resources, the institutional backing. And so we have to show you, you don't have to get a record when you put things on the record. We've got to call the bluff of the authorities. This is completely unacceptable. That week, President Obama was in Laos. He made this, you know, historic trip for a sitting president to go there. And the end of his trip, before he came back to the United States, he held a democracy forum for young Asian students from all over the region. And the last student raised her hand and said, President Obama, what about the Dakota Access Pipeline? No American journalists had dared to publicly ask President Obama this. I'm not talking Trump, I'm talking Obama. She might have seen some video online. And he held forth, he was very eloquent about the oppression of Native Americans over the centuries in the United States. And then he didn't have to say this, he could have just closed the forum, but he did say, as for the Dakota Access Pipeline, I have to look into it. I couldn't say to you right now what's happening. And reportedly, he came back to the United States that Wednesday, right before the decision on Friday. And he saw the video of the dogs biting the Native Americans. It wasn't lost on the first African-American president of the United States. I mean, at the end of our video, we had Winona LaDuc, the great indigenous activist from White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, saying, Governor Dalrymple, you are not George Wallace. This is not Alabama, 1965. We are through. President Obama understood the significance of this. And so when the judge did rule on Friday, terrible decision for the tribe. This was Obama's Justice Department prevailing over the Standing Rock Sioux. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening. We were just about to give our talk in Canada. but interestingly, you know, Obama didn't know it was going to happen. It's a judge. He does understand the separation of powers. But his Justice Department prevailed. And, you know, they're about to pop their champagne corks. They'd won over the tribe. And then the Obama administration released a three-agency letter, unprecedented, from the Justice Department. Their lawyers had just prevailed. Interior and Army Corps of Engineers saying, we're going to hold up. Even though we won, we're going to stop. And we're going to see if Native Americans were consulted and if there were proper environmental impact statements done. So, I mean, the people of Standing Rock were suffering whiplash. First, the worst decision ever, and then 15 minutes later, they're told maybe they won. that was in September. So we come back to New York. We know we have to go back to North Dakota. Well, I mean, I have to deal with an arrest warrant. So a few weeks later, we fly back in to Bismarck. And as we're landing at the airport, I am told that the prosecutors have decided to quash the arrest warrant. Of course, there was just no grounds to arrest me, but I was coming to answer the charges. They were going to quash the arrest warrant, but they were going to bring more serious charges against me. They were going to charge me with riot. So, I called my North Dakota lawyer, not that I had one before, and I said, from the airport. I said, I don't know, I think it was from the plane. I don't understand. He said, it's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, this could be a felony. It was not clear. I said, well, what does it mean? He said, I mean, at worst, you're going to face a year in jail. I said, I don't know about your life, but like 365 days, this matters to me. And so I said, so what's the next step? He said, it's Friday afternoon. You'll be arraigned Monday at 1:30. Okay, good. That gave us 3 days to cover the ongoing protests at the Standing Rock Zoo. And hope in the intervening time we wouldn't be arrested again. But I said, now what happens though? This is automatic arraignment at the courthouse in Mandan Monday at 1:30. He said, yeah, I mean, the judge signs off on it. I said, wait. A judge is going to sign off on this? He said, no, it's not. I said, I hear judge, I hear discretion. Judge could change his mind. And so he said, no, the judge, this is automatic. They rubber stamp all of the charges. But then when it comes to a trial, that's when they use their discretion. What's the judge's name, I asked. And so we put out a press release. We named the judge. And we said he would be making a decision this weekend on whether the charges would be brought. Well, to say the least, the media was now paying attention. So we were covering the protests through the weekend. The show must go on, so Dennis ordered a satellite truck from Minneapolis up for the show on Monday morning, right? It's 7 in the morning, North Dakota time, 8 New York time, that Democracy Now! Actually broadcasts 8 in the morning. And so we decided to broadcast in front of the Mandan Courthouse and Jail so I could just turn myself in afterwards. And so we broadcast from church property across the street, and the backdrop was the courthouse, the jail, and the Ten Commandments in between. You know, 90% of life is just showing up. You don't know this stuff until you actually go there and see the Ten Commandments on the court prop, not the church property that was across the street, but the court property. So that day, on Democracy Now!, as the sun came up, we set up our chairs and we had our floodlights and we interviewed the 45th chairman of the Standing Rock Zoo, Dave Archambault. You know, like Trump is the 45th president of the United States, Dave Archambault is the 45th chairman of the Standing Rock Zoo. And I asked him, have you ever been arrested? And he said, yes, a few months ago, I was arrested for civil disobedience. And I said, what did you face? And he said, it's low-level misdemeanor. I said, oh, so what happened? He said, well, I was strip searched. I was put in an orange jumpsuit, and I was jailed. For a low-level misdemeanor, like a parking ticket, you were strip searched, you were put in an orange jumpsuit, you're the 45th chairman of, do you think this might ever happen to the 45th president of the United States? Strip search, put in an orange jumpsuit, at least it would match, and jailed. So, and then I interviewed Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle. She's the pediatrician of the Standing Rock Zoo Reservation. She cares about the health of the kids, one of the first to be arrested, right? Deeply concerned that the pipeline going under the Missouri River would contaminate the water in the kids. So, what happened to you, I said. She said, low-level misdemeanor. I mean, it was for civil disobedience. And I said, and what happened? And she said, oh, I was strip searched, and I was put in an orange jumpsuit, and I was jailed. I mean, how much humiliation can a people take? I was at the airport one day in Bismarck, and I was reading a magazine waiting for a plane, and a guy came up to me and said, don't think I don't know who you are. And I said, oh, well, who are you? And he said, I'm one of the guards who was at the site that day. I recognize you. And so I said, oh, did you unleash the dogs on the protesters? And he said, no. He said, you don't understand. Some of us did not know that was going to happen. There were three different security companies that were hired by Dakota Access Pipeline. We were as appalled as anyone that that had happened. He said, you don't think I get it? We have massacred them for hundreds of years, and then we unleash dogs on them. You don't think I understand why they're angry? Never assume, based on a person's position, what their position will be. So that was our show that day. And then it was time to go to court or jail or something. I wasn't sure exactly. But hundreds of Native Americans came to perform ceremonies to show solidarity. And the media was really paying attention. I mean, the New York Times was covering this now. The Los Angeles Times, Al Jazeera, it was the homepage of the BBC. Vogue magazine was covering this. And when the media sheds its light in the right direction, I got a call right about that time when I was going to go across the street. The riot police were now lining up. From North Dakota Public Radio, longtime host there who knew every player. There are not that many players in North Dakota. And he said the judges decided not to sign off on the charges. I mean, this was one of the first times ever. It was not going to be a rubber stamp because of the media attention. But it was not only in my case. A number of the Native Americans that faced felony and misdemeanor charges that day had their charges dropped. This is what happens when the media spotlight shines in the right direction. I believe in reality television, not Trump's kind, but the kind that shows the reality of people's lives. That's the kind of television, that's the kind of media that will save the world. I really do think that the revolution could be televised. If people like those that run KDNK, people like those that believe in independent media, television, radio, independent websites, if we are able to build these networks, not only in the United States and around the world, the media is the great equalizing force, and it's that important. So what happened after that, you probably all know. The Dakota Access, President Obama said no, they would either reroute or not build it. This was in December. Trump had been elected, and in one of Trump's first acts in office, he green-lighted the Dakota Access Pipeline as well as the Keystone XL, which had been killed years before. It took Obama years until he finally stood down with what? 1,200 people made a circle around the White House. People like Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein were all arrested until President Obama said no to the Keystone XL. And, you know, Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein were just standing together just 2 days ago here and back in New York City with Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, making this historic announcement that they were... De Blasio was divesting the city's pension funds from fossil fuel. And they were suing the major oil corporations in the world. Movements matter. Even in very repressive times, when the stakes are so incredibly high, that's when movements like we're seeing today, even when you're feeling like you're giving up hope, movements make an enormous difference. I just want to end by saying all of this is happening as we move into Martin Luther King's birthday, right? He would have been 89 years old, born in 1929, 89 years old. Martin Luther King, when you look at his life and what he did, he was not just one individual. I mean, you look back to 1955 when he started the Montgomery bus boycott, led that movement. It wasn't actually Dr. King that started it. It was Rosa Parks, of course. Rosa Parks, December 1st, 1955, sits down on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, refuses to get up for a white passenger. She's arrested. 5 days later, December 5th, 1955, she has to go to court. Montgomery Improvement Association has its meeting to choose a leader to lead the Montgomery bus boycott to end segregation in public transportation. And they choose as their leader a young minister who just moved into town, Dr. Martin Luther King. Rosa Parks helped to launch Dr. Martin Luther King. And to show how brave she was, you can just go back a few months before to the summer of 1955, the summer of a young boy, 14 years old, from Chicago. A young boy whose mother, Mamie Till, decided she didn't want her son, Emmett Till, to be in this hot Chicago summer and sent him to Mississippi to be with his family. Mamie Till, well, let me say before I talk about Mamie Till, Rosa Parks was deeply influenced by what happened to Emmett Till, this 14-year-old boy. And it shows how brave Rosa was when she did this. It was just a few months later. When Rosa Parks died a few years ago, I remember CNN specifically saying Rosa Parks was a tired seamstress. She was no troublemaker. And that's where they got it wrong, because Rosa Parks was a first-class troublemaker. She knew exactly what she was doing. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked under E.D. Nixon. He came out of radical labor politics, who had organized with A. Philip Randolph, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, to challenge the Pullman cars run by George Pullman. All the sleeping car porters, thousands of them, were called George for George Pullman, not because they were named that. But Mamie Till, Rosa Parks, even before she had sat down on that bus, she had been fighting for women's rights throughout the South. She was a first-class troublemaker. You may have heard Oprah's speech last week at the Golden Globe Awards. Did you hear in the middle what she said about a woman named Recy Taylor, who in 1945 was raped in Abbeville, Alabama? Who was the woman who came to take her story down and challenge the authorities and demand justice? It was a young secretary of the NAACP in Montgomery, Rosa Parks, who was spending her life documenting women's stories, talking about being raped as domestic servants, women who were coming from church, as Recy Taylor was. And a film just came out called The Rape of Recy Taylor, a documentary that Oprah referred to. And Recy Taylor died just a few days ago at the age of 101. It took until 2011 for the Alabama legislature, more than half a century later, to apologize for not bringing any of the six men who had raped her to justice. But it was Rosa Parks who was documenting all these stories. Rosa Parks, who was so incredibly brave, knew exactly what she was doing when she sat down on the bus. Yes, she was a troublemaker. The media denigrates activists, but what can be more noble than dedicating your life to making the world a better place? So going back a few months to Emmett Till and what inspired Rosa to do what she did, Emmett Till is sent to Mississippi to be with his aunt and uncle and cousins for the summer. He's at home asleep when a white mob comes and rips him out of bed because they said he had wolf whistled at a white woman. They dragged him out of bed, they beat him, they tortured him, and he ended up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. When his body was dredged up and sent back to Chicago for the funeral, his mother, Mamie Till, did something incredibly brave. She said, "I want his casket open for the wake and the funeral. I want the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry." And so thousands of people streamed by his casket and saw his mutilated, distended head. And then Jet Magazine and other black publications took photographs of his head. And they were actually published. And they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till Mobley had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. Could you imagine if we saw the images of war for 1 week, whether it's the war at home, about environmental degradation, we actually saw on a regular basis what was happening in North Dakota? Could you imagine if we saw above the fold of every surviving newspaper a picture of a baby dead on the ground in Yemen, either from cholera or because of a US drone strike, and we learned the baby's name and who her family was? If everyone on their Facebook page, if everyone in every tweet, in every email they sent for 1 week talked about a soldier dead and dying in Afghanistan for 1 week, people would care. you know, Americans are a compassionate people. And they would say, no, war, environmental degradation, these are not the answers in the 21st century. This is why there is so much hope in the face of Donald Trump, and why it's so important to acknowledge this incredibly brave civil rights history in this country that he so loathes. Because most people in this country know this is what makes America great. That is the hope as we move into this Martin Luther King weekend, Democracy Now!